Kuang wants to talk about an outboard that is hard to start whenever it's warm. Thank you for commenting and for subscribing. The question is, my 1998 Honda BF90A has been super reliable, I guess because it was maintained by the sheriff when I bought it. The past weeks, it started to have hard-to-start issues only when after smooth cruise to open water and left off for more than a couple of hours. Choke won't work, but it will start after around 30 tries. Sounded like fuel is not going in, but I change everything, including the water separator, shows clean fuel, runs perfectly after it starts, and can start again without even pushing the fuel in. I can't replicate the issue by leaving engine off for overnight or lower unit submerged. Both fire right off, not a problem, but it happened twice already in the open water, left me feel a little uncomfortable. Lower unit gear lube shows signs of leaks by milky color, though. I don't know if that will be then cause of it. I am completely lost. So a lot going on here. Lower unit thing completely separate. Like, that has nothing to do with the hard to start whenever it's warm. Now, the discussion is going to go multiple different ways because it's going to vary depending on car rated versus EFI. This engine is a 98 Honda BF90. I'm pretty sure there's 4 carburetors on this engine. So we're talking about carburetors to start. Usually this is going to be a fuel issue. Generally, it's a fuel issue, which is going to be a heat related issue where you are having a vapor lock condition. So changing the fuel lines, all that stuff, that can happen. If you use a quality fuel line, you shouldn't have to change it every couple of years. I know people still buy that gray blue fuel line that has a separate liner. I would not buy that stuff because it can deteriorate and can cause you all kinds of problems. But if you use a quality fuel line, you shouldn't have to change it all the time. People are, acting like this is a maintenance thing. It's not. It's fuel line. You should have a good fuel line that lasts years and years and years. But outside of that, he said he's changed the water separator, no water, all that stuff. So all that's good. First problem could be an anti-siphon valve, but I highly doubt it. That is, one thing that, if you've got fuel, it heats up. Whenever fuel heats up, it creates vapor. Vapor can create pressure, which can give you all kinds of problems. It can flood things, which is most likely the problem here with the carburetor, is that the fuel is heating up, which is creating pressure, and it's pushing fuel in, and it's flooding the engine, which makes it difficult to start. And even if you try and prime it or choke it, it's not going to start. The anti-siphon valve plays a part in this, where the vapor can mess with the anti-siphon valve, but not generally related to what you're talking about here. The most likely is that it's flooding. So somehow maybe the engine's running too hot. So checking all your cooling systems, the thermostat, the impeller, all that stuff, making sure that the engine is running at proper temperature so when you shut it off, everything's cooling down properly. Because if it's not and everything's staying hot, then that is what's, vaporizing your fuel, which is probably flooding it. It's flooding the carburetors. So I would say to clean the carburetors, and you most likely have a problem with the carbs. Other than that, it could be electrical. But that's usually like 2-stroke older stuff where you've got an ignition coil problem where the ignition coils are heating up. And once they get hot, you turn the engine off and try and restart it and they will not produce spark. They won't produce enough spark. They might be timed improperly, which would be more like a stator problem or a trigger problem where once the stator trigger heats up, it will throw off your timing, which means your spark won't be when it should be. And then also, you could have a timer-based problem. Again, this is all 2-stroke, not BF90 4-stroke stuff. But, the timer base, older 2-strokes, the stator, there would be like a resin on the stator that would melt. It would fall down on the timer base and that would mess up your timer base. So a couple different things there, like multiple different problems that could be. For the Honda problem, I'm going to say that you've got a vapor lock problem and a dirty carburetor problem. And that's why whenever it's cold, everything works fine. But whenever you run it for a little while, it's vapor locking, possibly flooding your carburetors. And then that is, making it to where the engine won't start. A couple different fixes are going to be to clean the carburetors. And then also I would, you know, let it idle a little bit. This is like a two-stroke thing that a lot of people used to do with two-strokes is you would let the engine idle. So let's say you're running somewhere or a long extended trolling time. It don't just turn the engine off immediately. Just kind of get where you're going. Let the engine run for another 5-10 minutes, whatever, and idle there. So that way it can burn off a lot of the vapors, get the fuel system to like settle out. And then, you know, any kind of vapor or anything is going to work its way out. And then when you go to restart it, you can try and open up the throttle plates. So put it in neutral, open up your throttle plates. So that way it lets air in there. So if it is a flooding issue, it's going to help by introducing air. It's going to rev up whenever it starts up, but it's just one thing that might help the situation. Now, when we go over and start talking about EFI engines that won't start whenever they're hot, it's the same concept. It's usually a vapor problem where the fuel is heating up. It's not being able to cool. This could be a clogged fuel cooler. It could be a problem with the pressure regulator. It could be a problem in the VST where the VST is not allowing the vapor separator tank to allow the vapors to leave, and therefore it is pressurizing everything in the VST, again causing all kinds of issues. Vapor locking to where you try and start it and it's usually flooded or not getting any fuel. Some of them you can just prime them up with the primer bulb, open your throttle plates, and that lets air into the system and allows it to start. But other than that, generally hot starts or no start when hot conditions are fuel related. It's a heat thing. So if you've changed fuel lines recently and the fuel line got stuck somewhere where it's up against the block and it's getting hot, or portable fuel tanks, if you don't have the vent right, that could be a problem, but that's usually not a start condition. Usually that's a running issue. But I'm going to say clean the carburetors on the Honda, try and let it idle a little bit before you turn the engine off, and then make sure your cooling system is operating properly. DOP wants to know, did you come across or work on diesel outboards, Ox or Cox or Yanmar or who knows what brands? I remember videos on YouTube and hype about them, mainly Ox and Cox. I don't really do a lot with diesels, so no, not really had a lot of experience with them. Heard great things about them. I mean, you're getting that power of a diesel only built in an outboard package, which makes them a lot nicer because you can get all of the running gear. You can get everything out of the water because it's an outboard. You can tilt everything up. So that is, you know, a big benefit, but you're also getting that power that you get with a diesel. You can move weight. Diesels are good at moving a lot of weight. They're not really built for speed. You know, you're not going to get top end speed like you can with gasoline because you can get those RPM up. Whereas diesel kind of runs lower RPM, but it's meant for slinging bigger props, moving heavier boats, moving more weight. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with them. No, but everything I've heard nothing but good things about them. I'm glad that it's finally here where there was such a long time where you didn't have that option of a diesel outboard, but now you do. So I think it's a good thing, and I don't think that there's very many problems with them from what I've heard, especially from Ox or Cox. Yanmar does, I want to say Yanmar does have an outboard diesel, but I don't really know a whole lot about all that stuff. MP95 Wellcraft 264 Coastal, just acquired one and wondering if it is worth repowering. I mean, repowering is going to be totally based on you and whether or not you like the boat. So if you like the boat, then 100% repower it. A 95, so now you are talking about, you know, almost a 30-year-old boat. So on a Wellcraft, you're going to want to look at that transom. What's that transom look like? And then also the fuel tank. What does your fuel tank look like? 264 Wellcraft. I don't know what the stringers, if those are wood cord stringers. I'm pretty sure that's a wood cord transom though. So definitely checking out those two things, because if you're going to put money into an engine and spin on a 264, you might have twins on that, but it might have a single. So, you know, you're going to be spending 30 to 50, 60 grand on a repower. So if you like the boat, it's totally worth it. But if you're going to spend that amount of money, make sure the fuel tank and the transom are good to go, because you don't want to spend $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 putting brand new engine or engines on the boat just to come to find that you got to spend another 10 grand on the transom or the fuel tank. So definitely checking that kind of stuff out. That goes for any boat too, not necessarily just the Wellcraft, because I like a Wellcraft. I had the 20 Fisherman, and that was a 92, and that boat was phenomenal. I mean, it rode really, really nice, and it had a dry ride. So, you know, I think the Wellcraft brand is a good brand. They make a good boat, and they ride nice. You know, as far as the boat goes, you know, good to go. But any 30-year-old boat, you're going to want to be careful, again, of the transom and the fuel tank, because those two things will hit you on later on, and they ain't a cheap fix. It's a $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 fix, depending on how bad it is, what kind of boat it is, who does it, what all needs to be done when you do it. So it can get expensive quick, and I think number one thing to look at are those things. Mr. Litt, Century builds a stout boat. I have a 2022, and it is an absolute tank. Huge fiberglass gussets from the stringers to the transom. Yeah, Century, ever since Century got bought in early 2000s, they, you know, the new Centuries, I don't have anything bad to say about them. The old ones, there was some problems there. Not a huge fan of the old ones, the 90s models. But after, I'm not sure exactly what year Century was bought out, or, you know, I don't think they bought out. I think they went bankrupt, or they closed shop. And then the new Century bought the molds, and now the molds are what they use, but it's a completely different boat. I mean, they build it completely differently than they used to. So not 100% on the whole, you know, separation there between, you know, the old brand and the new brand. But from what I've seen, the new Centuries, yeah, they do look like a decent boat. I've got no complaints. I have not heard anything terrible about them. Anthony says, thanks, Aaron. Thank you, Anthony. How can I mount a T-top to a boat, specially installed to a Carolina skiff? The floors aren't as strong as a normal boat. Any informative tips? I don't know a whole bunch about Carolina skiffs, and depending on the model that you have, you know, a lot of those are flat bottom. So the build system and between the deck and the hull, the distance there, you know, it's going to depend on the model and how you go. Obviously, you want to try and mount your T-top to your stringers. That's going to be the best way. But, you know, some models, you might not have that option, and going just straight into the deck is kind of what it is. So depending on how the console is secured, I would be looking at the console and see what the console looks like. You know, how is that secured to the deck? And then looking in the bilge. If you look in the bilge, can you see the stringers on the side of the boat? Because if you can see the stringers, you can measure from the bilge over and get a distance there. And then that way, you know, mark the middle of the boat, measure over. You can go up to the console and mark over, and you can hit your stringers. So that way you can screw directly into your stringers, and that's going to give you the most, you know, stability when it comes to securing the T-top. But it, depending on how stout the console is being bolted to the deck and how that is attached, you could also have success. You know, I don't know if you're buying a T-top, if you're having one made, you might even consider that, where four legs going to the deck, and then also maybe, you know, some type of other braces that come off the tubes that go and attach to the console. So that way you've also got, you know, that attachment point too. You're going to want it to go to the console anyway, because you're going to want to run stuff up to the top. I mean, by and large, you're going to need to have power to the top, so that way you can put an anchor light up there, VHF antenna, radio antenna possibly, GPS puck possibly, you know, are you going to put an electronics box up there? So I'd be thinking about that kind of stuff as well. Securing it, you know, number 14, the bigger screw, the better. And, you know, they're going to be four screws on each post. So there's not a lot to securing it. It's you put 4,200 down and you screw the thing down to the deck. If you can get it made to where it touches the stringers and gets on the stringers, even better. The Carolina skiff thing, I'm not 100% sure which model and how that is exactly all, you know, how the boat is built and everything's put together down under there. Maverick wants to know, very informative podcast. Thank you, Maverick. Here's a question. Is a Land and Sea Donovan account worth it for parts and accessories, or is it better to just know someone with one of those accounts? Just trying to find the best way to get parts at the manufacturer's price. Can you buy directly from manufacturer? If so, how? So I could have swore that we've talked about this before, but it's on the list, so let's talk about it. No, you can't buy from the dealer. So you can't buy from Mercury, Yamaha, Suzuki, Tohatsu, none of those companies. They all have a dealer network, and the dealer network is how they distribute their parts. So you have to be part of a dealership to get parts, you know, other than going through partsview.com or something like that, where it's a third party that has a dealership status that then, you know, is a third party distribution for the OEM parts. So Land and Sea is owned by Brunswick. It's separate from Donovan. Land and Sea has Quicksilver, and I think you can even order Mercury stuff through Land and Sea, not 100%. Most of them all, whether that's Port Supply being West Marine, Donovan, Land and Sea, Jerry's or Lewis or whatever it is now. I don't know if they got bought out by Donovan or whatever happened there, but all these companies are going to be like, they're going to have certain stipulations. So some of them require you to have a location, like a business location. You have to be a business, like an LLC, with a EIN number and, you know, sales tax certificate or whatever it's called. And then also usually they have a minimum. So you have to buy $5,000 worth of parts per year. And then like Port Supply, which is West Marine, that is a tiered system. So I want to say like they're like three different tiers, like, you know, a VIP and two other tiers where it's like you spend $6,000, $15,000, and $25,000 or something like that per year. So if you buy $25,000 worth of parts, you get the bigger discount and you are VIP or whatever it is. So they're all tiered systems. So unless you're buying a decent amount of parts, usually it doesn't really make sense because of that. Most of them don't have like a fee. So there's not like a, you know, annual fee or whatever to be part of a dealer. But you do have to be a business, and you know it's all going to depend on where you're at and how much work you're doing. How many parts are you going through? Like, are you, you know, buying and selling them? Other companies also have other ways that you can become a dealer with them, like partsview.com and boats.net. They have like a different tiered system as well where you can be part of that, and they can, you know, you get discounts based on that. But other than that, you know, just knowing somebody, if you know a dealership that will work a relationship with you, you could always do that, which is, you know, probably going to be more beneficial depending on how much stuff you're doing. If you can get a relationship with a dealership that, you know, when you're starting out or if you're small and you don't need that many parts, that's going to be the best way. But if you're just trying to buy parts for your own engine, you know, trying to get a deal and a discount on buying parts when you're only, you know, you buy, you know, a couple gallons of oil and an impeller every other year, like that, I don't know if you're really going to get a dealership or a company to, you know, give you a discount, a deal on that, because that's how they're in business. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's their business model. Like, they have to pay all the taxes and the fees and buy all the parts and have the insurance and all the liability and all the overhead to stay in business. And, you know, they stay in business by selling parts that are marked up to make a profit. So your situation is going to vary depending on that, but hopefully that gives you a little bit more information on, you know, whether or not you should look into becoming a business or whatever your situation may be. Bill Zinkan, how often should I use Salt Away on my Yamaha 150 outboard? It's always used in salt water. So if you use it all the time, it's going to work great. If you've got a 10, 15 year old engine that has never been flushed like that, any kind of buildup that's in the engine, that's not going to get that out. Like Salt Away is going to clean to a point, but it is not going to get rid of barnacles or heavy corrosion, heavy salt buildup, mineral deposits, that kind of stuff. It's really not going to get that stuff away. We have a video on this where, I show kind of what it looks like when you run Salt Away. So, if you do set up a recirculating pump to where you run the engine in, say, a bucket with the Salt Away in the bucket, and then, make sure the pee is going down in there and you can just run it for a long time, you'll be able to clean a lot out of the engine. But Salt Away is really good if, like, you buy a brand new engine or you have an engine that's, say, 5 years old, so it's not that old. It doesn't have a lot of time to have a lot of buildup inside the cooling passages. Then Salt Away is going to be very good to use every couple trips, or if you want to, every time you flush. But that is going to, it's more of a maintenance type thing. It's not really a cleaning, like, it's not going to, clean out the cooling passages of stuff that's already built up. It just helps to maintain and keep salt buildup from happening. So I personally would say that if you run it once a month or once every, six trips or whatever, then it's going to do what you want it to do. I mean, it's a great product. I've used it before, so it does work, but just knowing that delineation between previous buildup and preventing buildup is kind of what it's going to look like for you. Alejandro with twins, what side does the counter-rotating Mercury motor go on? Well, that's going to depend. So by and large, mostly the left hand or counter-rotating goes on the left side, and then the standard right hand goes on the right, but that means your props are spinning out like this. So it helps to track the boat going straight, but it also, like, you're pushing water away. So if you swap them, which a lot of companies do, I want to say that whenever you swap them, it gives you stern lift, because now the props are spinning in, and when they spin in, it, like, lifts the transom. So you're going to get stern lift when you swap them. So whether, there's not really a right or wrong way to do it. It all depends on how you want your boat to do. If your boat is very bow heavy and it plows through the water more, like it's older, you got a lot of weight in the front, stuff like that, you don't want your, you don't want them swapped over to give you stern lift. You want them to be facing out. So by and large, 90, 95% of every boat that's a twin engine, the counter goes on the left and the standard goes on the right, right hand, left hand. But swapping them is not a bad thing. It's just for a different application. Kane Jarvis, we put the 300 horsepower with the DES on 26 foot ribs. DES is Yamaha's digital electronic steering, and put it on a rib boat, and you can turn the boat 90 degrees at 35 knots with one finger. Pretty impressive system. So, yeah, a lot of the steering systems, the digital electric steering systems, are super impressive. Some are better than others. I would say that Mercury and Yamaha have the best, but that's because they're proprietary. It's not a third-party thing. They're specifically designed for their engines. And, yeah, like, it's on a dime. Like, when you one finger move that thing, there's no resistance, because your helm is electronic and the actuator on the back is electric. So, as soon as you turn, like, it's going to turn. And so, yeah, it's pretty amazing system. I can see where it could be, a problem. There has been quite a few issues with other steering systems. And being electric, you have problems. If you lose power, you have bad connections, you have fuse problems where, it'll mess up your steering. And you lose steering, that's a big deal. So whereas, with hydraulic, you can still manually move stuff. Whereas electric, if something happens, man, like, that's it. Your steering's gone. But it is a super impressive system. And to be honest, I don't think there's that many problems. You know, Evinrude with the G2s, they had a lot of problems with their electric, you know, that whole steering system, but that's a whole nother topic. As far as the DES is concerned and Yamaha's, it's outstanding. I don't think they've had that many problems. I mean, you know, you haven't heard too much about any of the XTOs having any kind of steering problems or anything like that. So I think the issues are very, very minimal when it comes to the new steering systems. Charles Driggers says, unless their prices become competitive and they gain a way better dealer network, Honda, as for their marine division, will always be last. They also need to lose the reputation of being slow. You're right, Charles. I think Honda does have the reputation of being slower and heavier. I don't know, you know, if it's that true anymore. I mean, granted, so the new BF350, that thing's almost 800 pounds. It's like 700 some pounds. Whereas Mercury's Mercury's V10 350 is also 795 pounds or whatever, 700 some pounds. So like the weight comparison there is pretty close. Outside of Yamaha's 4.3 F350, which comes in at like, you know, I want to say just under 700 pounds. That it is 629 pounds. So, I mean, that one is astronomically lighter than the Honda and the Mercury. But again, that's a V6, not a V8 or a V10. So, you know, that there is that discussion there. So Honda might not be as heavy as you think. I mean, it is a little bit heavier, but, you know, for power to weight ratio, it's maybe a little bit heavier. Now, as far as being slow and that reputation, I mean, yeah, you're right. They do have that reputation, but I don't really know if they're that slow. I mean, it's not really any slower than any of the other brands. Well, I mean, Mercury's obviously faster than everybody because that's what they want to be. But the dealer network, I think, is the bigger problem. The lack of a dealer network, and they've had corrosion issues in salt water before where they were seen to not hold up because of the dissimilar metals and the things that they use to make the engines. But as far as reliability goes, the engine is a super reliable engine, but the dealer network is the problem. That's the same thing with what's going on with Evinrude and all these people that bought these G2s and have all these engines for Evinrude. You got a 10-year warranty, but you can't get any, like, where are you going to take the boat? Like, you got to drive 4 hours away to find a dealer that will work on your stuff. And then now you've got to wait 4 months because you're on a list of 100 other people that are trying to get stuff. So, you know, the dealer network is probably the biggest concern that I would have as, you know, as far as Honda is concerned, because, you know, if you want to make a break into the industry and, you know, become competitive, then you definitely need to have a dealer network where somebody doesn't have to drive 400 miles towing their boat to get work done or get parts or stuff like that. Which, going back to what Maverick was talking about, you know, can you buy parts from the dealers? No, you can't. So if you can't get parts and you got to go to a dealer that's 4 hours away, that's a problem. And a lot of people that have an Evinrude now are, you know, stuck in that boat where they got a boat, they got 3-4 year old engines with 7 years of warranty left, but you can't get work done on it. So I would say that is probably a bigger concern when it comes to, you know, being competitive and gain market share in the marine division. Granted, I love to see Honda getting more into it with the BF350, doing that deal with Scout where they're making a 19.5 boat for Honda. So, you know, things are happening. And, you know, the more they get into the marine industry, that's just better for everybody in the boating. You know, having more options is way better for the consumer than not having options. I mean, when you live in a socialistic, communistic regime where you get this and that's it, that's your only choice, then, you know, you take what you can get. So definitely the more the better, 100%. And, you know, I'm a fan of Honda. I said it multiple times before. Honda seems to dominate every product that they make except for boats. So, you know, I think if they wanted to be in the game, that they would be more. And I think that they are hopefully getting into it. So, yeah, figure out the dealer network problem, Honda, please. Mark Dime, boating industry will price themselves out of business. Maybe. I mean, you know, honestly, I kind of look at it like this, where like, so we're at the Miami Boat Show, and I'm going to do a video on this that talks more about these numbers, but I surveyed, not really surveyed, but documented 280 boats at the convention center. And I'll tell you right now that the average price of a brand new boat was $299,000. So, and also not to mention that out of the 280 boats that I looked at, 80% of them were over $100,000. So only 20% of the boats at the boat show were under $100,000. So the days of the average Joe and the middle, you know, middle class kind of guy buying a brand new boat, it doesn't. Like, they have literally, I mean, inflation and economics and everything else, whole different political discussion that we're not going to get into, but just in general, as talking about the prices, the price of a brand new boat, yeah, you've priced most of the middle people out, and I get it. I mean, you know, stuff costs money to make. Shipping stuff, manufacturing stuff, getting products, assembly, you know, the whole nine yards, everything is astronomically higher. But yeah, the average person, if you're a middle class person, you can't buy a brand new boat. Like, let's just face it, you can't afford new. You got to buy old, you got to buy used, which, I mean, I would consider myself middle class, and I've never bought anything new in my life. I've never had a new car, new house, none of that stuff. So new boat, no different. I buy them for $1,000 and put $4,000 in them and make them, you know, usable. So the day of going to the boat show for the average guy and buying a brand new boat is, as of right now, it doesn't exist. I mean, you have to have over $100,000. And I think a lot of it has to do with financing and everybody financing everything. So if you can get a 20, 30, 40 year loan on a boat, I mean, that's what people do. They make the payments and then they get rid of it. So, you know, I think part of that plays into that, where people see the option of just taking financing and making payments, to where you want to buy a new boat. Okay, so you plan on holding this boat for, let's say, 4 or 5 years. So you say, okay, I can buy this boat. It's going to cost me $250, $300 a month. So I'll buy a boat. It's going to cost me $300 a month. That's going to cost me $3,600 a year. And over 5 years, this is what it's going to cost me to buy this boat. So that's what people look at. They just make the payment, and then they get rid of it, and they don't care about the depreciation, the value, the longevity, or any of the other stuff. And then also, one of the things that I've noticed on most of the new boats is that everything's decked out, like fully decked out. The most of the boats come with so much stuff that there isn't really, the market has kind of shifted to where people want more stuff in them. They want the cushions, they want, you know, the tackle centers, the live wells, they want the washdown systems, the shower systems, the brackets, the Euro transoms, the cushions in the back, the seatings, the side doors going out the side, you know, four displays on the front, everything digital switching. Like, the market is like asking for everything, and you can't really find a boat that is like stripped down. Like, you know, obviously you can build your own custom boat. Like, if you go to CV, you can get whatever you want. You want to buy a hull? Great. You want to buy, you know, fully stripped down with nothing in it? You can do that. So there are brands that will work with you like that. But, you know, those brands like CV, they're not selling anybody anything. Like, you know, they don't sell their product. Like, they just supply. It's a distribution center. Like, they are a dispensary. It's kind of like, you know, drugs. Like people buy that kind of stuff because they're addicted and they want it. So, like, you know, CV isn't out trying to sell boats because people want them. The product is so good that people, you know, they want it. So like, you know, they're just there to give people what they want, and they are a dispensary of the boat. So, you know, kind of a little tangent there, but yeah, I think that they are kind of pricing, you know, being able to buy a new boat, you can't really do that anymore. It's astronomically high, and the boats are coming with so much stuff that the like average guy that just wants to go out and get yellowtail, you know, you just go out, bottom fish for a little bit, get some mahi, come back in, and that's it. You don't want the radar and the 5K transducers and the autopilot and, you know, lights every inch of the boat, the underwater lights, the joystick piloting, the you know, the spotlights, the floodlight, like all this stuff, the sound system. Like, there's a lot of people that don't want all that stuff. All they want to do, you know, they're happy with two speakers and a head unit and, you know, a decent GPS. That's it. Like, you know, they'll put a cooler in the back. They'll have a little tackle center, and that's it. You're kind of set up. You get out, you go out, you catch yellowtail, you come back. And those boats, there's not many companies making boats like that anymore. I mean, seeing that the average boat was over $100,000, most of them, it's that 25 to 30 foot range, or even up into the 35. I want to say like 40% of the boats were over 30 feet. So having a market where the consumers are buying 35 foot boats, like, it is, you know, there's no money in building a 20 foot boat because no one buys it. And so, you know, it's a hard topic, but, you know, you let us know what you think in the comment section below.